down by the water.
Welcome back to season 2 of the Run Culture Podcast. My name is Dane Verway. I'm an experienced running physiotherapist, coach, and marathoner. This season will involve open discussions with my running colleagues about the key principles behind injury-free running and optimal performance. It'll be backed by personal experience, science, and history. I can only hope some of these chats inspire curiosity and expand or confirm perspectives and beliefs amongst the running community. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Run Culture Podcast. Today, I'm absolutely rapt to have the balanced runner, Jay Grunke, on the show. Jay has over 20 years' experience as a certified Feldenkrais practitioner and in helping runners become more attuned, embodied, and aware of their movement. As a result, she has helped many enjoy their running more, have less pain, and move faster. On top of this, Jay was also a professional dancer for 13 years. So I'm excited to chat to Jay today because, as you can tell from the range of guests I've had on the podcast over the past 6 to 12 months, I'm really infatuated with the idea that running is a skill and, two, the messy, explorative nature of motor learning. So what better person to chat to today than a dancer, turned runner, and a Feldenkrais practitioner? Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Dane. Really thrilled to be here.
Jay, many listeners will be wondering what Feldenkrais is and how you have been helping runners with this method. Do you mind, opening up with a chat about that?
Sure. Yeah. The Feldenkrais method of movement education is, well, what it says on the tin. If you get if you add the last part of the phrase, it all gets clearer. It was developed by a man named Moshe Feldenkrais, who was most connected with our two top global hotspots at the moment. He was born in Ukraine in 1913, I believe. Sooner than that. Anyway, and lived much of his life in Israel. So he was a physicist and engineer and polymath, and he was also the first European to have a black belt in judo. He could have gone any number of directions with that. He also worked in the Curie's lab in Paris, and helped in the development of sonar and many accomplishments as a scientist and engineer. He got hurt. And he was unhappy with the medical options for resolving that in the 1950s when it happened, a knee injury. And because he was given 50% chance that surgery would resolve his issue, apparently he could grab his kneecap and just like slide it around in front of his knee. It was a pretty bad injury. And he's like, 50% is the toss of a coin. I'm sure I can do better than that. And so he studied motor learning and everything that bore upon it that he was available to him in the 50s, and was able to teach himself to walk again without pain, at which point other people started asking him for help with their bad backs or whatever, and he began to develop a method. And ultimately, that's what he worked on for the rest of his life. And so that's what the Feldenkrais method of movement education is. It uses the ways that we actually learn movement from infancy. So it doesn't involve instruction because no baby was ever effectively instructed on how to roll over or crawl or sit. And having that process, we can learn whatever is important to us in our lives. And so the method is used for high performers, for sure, top athletes and artists, but also for people who have significant challenges, stroke recovery, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, cerebral palsy. There are people who, Feldenkrais practitioners who work with infants from like the day of their birth. It can also be used with animals. So a huge range of applications. And your garden variety back pain, we eat for breakfast. I'm good at that. So I encountered the method when I was a dancer with very bad Achilles tendon problems and nothing else had helped me. Though to be fair, in retrospect, I wasn't getting the very best physical therapy that was out there. But I don't think it would have helped in any case. The Feldenkrais method got me back to dancing and made me a much better dancer than I had ever been before. So really gave me the gift of the career that I had always wanted and felt should be possible, but hadn't been able to get to just by going to class, you know, dance classes. And then when I was satisfied with my dance career and ready to move on, and I became a Feldenkrais practitioner myself, and in my final days as a dancer, I became involved in running. I needed to run for a dance job, and dancers are famous for hating to run. And there's a good reason, because dance technique, like a ballet-based technique, sets you up very poorly to run. And it's hard to feel what you need to change. And yet, like, I felt like I can do now all these things that normal people couldn't imagine doing, right? So why can't I do a fundamental human gait? So I became fascinated with that question. And I used my Feldenkrais professional training program to study what the difference was between what I was doing and what people who looked graceful and elegant and like the ways that you're describing, that kind of dancerly way of running, the gazelle way of running, and work out the difference and get myself to where I felt that way running too, and to where I felt like actually running feels much nicer than dancing. So that's when I finally retired as a dancer and built my Feldenkrais practice really around the discoveries that I made and around, you know, my perception that you could be a runner your whole life. You could read everything that's out there, especially at this time, which was the early 2000s. When did I graduate? 2003. Never hear anybody talk about the stuff that really makes running feel great, and the things that the runners who run well and easily, and the way humans are meant to do the things that they do to run that way. And I thought there's a desperate need for this information, and so that's been my focus ever since. And because running is so profoundly human, and so rich and complex, you know, 20 years later, I still have many interesting questions ahead of me.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'll ever feel like I've unraveled this mystery completely, but yeah. So I rolled right on from Feldenkrais to myself there, but anyway.
No, that's
hopefully that gives a background that will make sense to people about why the Feldenkrais method should matter to a runner.
That's great. And you mentioned there, like, as babies, we learn through exploration and trying things and mucking up, and then eventually learning what works and through trial and error. You know, if that is like instinctual, how do we all go wrong, and how do we end up in pain and feeling like we're finding it hard to run and move well with the ground? I think that's important to sort of understand in terms of the bigger picture.
Yeah for sure. So I mean, I really The thing that makes running toughest for us is really just modern life and society. You know, honestly, it's just not built around movement, and it really supports us in not moving, and especially not moving quickly and being able to coordinate the actions that produce running. So, you know, in a way, you know, it's not a failure that we have so much difficulty running. It's that we have succeeded in learning to function within the modern world, right? We have succeeded in figuring out how to get ourselves into chairs and stay there for prolonged periods of time. And any kid who doesn't succeed in that is gonna flunk out of school. So the stakes are high, right?
Yep.
You know, it's because we can learn and because we have learned. But that leaves, that requires us to leave many of our movement capacities behind because we're not using them. You know, the brain is use it or lose it. If you don't have use for a set of connections for a part of your self-image, you're not going to power that. I'm sorry, there's a metaphor here that I've never tried before with cloud servers. But anyway, you get the idea. Like, you're not going to. Brains are expensive. You're not going to keep that real estate devoted to something that you don't even ever use.
Yep.
And then our bodies change as well. But I think the bigger factor is this change in our brains and our thinking and our understanding of how our bodies work and how to coordinate them for this, you know, honestly, novel activity. So.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I been listening to you on other podcasts and I've heard you say that, and then I've heard you mention even like the idea of today's day and age, we're a bit more of an impatient culture and our attention spans have shortened. There's also this overwhelming sort of like message of, you know, tough it out and force it. With a lot of things, and then you know, an over reliance on technology here and there. Like, technology can be great, but then suddenly many of us are becoming a bit disembodied, and then just an over reliance with so many instructional videos out there, and not sort of really sure of what we should do anymore. I can really see how we can get into a little bit of a mess of not really feeling our movement and being aware of our movement. And just before you mentioned the body map, what is the body map?
So I think this is really important to understand. Especially when you want to improve how you do something, which is that, you know, we all have a map of our body and our brains, maybe more than one. Science is ongoing, investigation is ongoing. It's called your homunculus or a sensory motor map. And it's a representation of your body, like what you have and what it can do. And we're always making and revising this map. Like, we weren't born with it. It would be pretty obsolete if we had been, right? Because our bodies are quite different. So we make it the way all maps are made, through exploration. And then we keep it relevant, you know, like I said, because it's not on a piece of paper, the brain requires energy and these connections always need to be renewed or they're repurposed. So revisions that happen to your homunculus, to your sensory motor map over time, would take place because of what you habitually do and then what you habitually don't do. So sitting in chairs being absolutely enormous for the question of running, but not the only thing. And then you get into specifics. Well, what if you're a wrestler? What if you do a lot of Tai Chi? What if you're a horseback rider? That has massive ramifications for any ability to run. So so because of the specific habits you build and the ones that you exclude. So So those things change our map. And then even more so if you have pain. So if you get hurt or develop some sort of overuse injury or chronic pain, you immediately change how you move. That's not a conscious process. I mean, you'll be aware of the changes that you've made, and there's a lot of complexity about that. But in any case, your map is immediately different at that moment that you feel pain. And without an intentional learning process, because pain is apparently a threat to your survival, and survival is the most important thing, without a particular kind of learning process, you won't ever recover what you removed or lost from your map in response to that experience of pain. And that's the vast majority of runners have had that experience, right? And are running with the consequences of that. So.
Yeah, it's funny, like you mentioned like riding horses before, and I heard you mention that actually on another podcast. And funnily enough, like this week I treated an equestrian rider who's doing a bit more running now, and he presented exactly as you said. He had no he even in bare feet he was slapping the road as he was running and had no connection with, he just, yeah, his feet were sort of stuck in this sort of dorsiflexed rigid kind of pattern, and he just didn't have that a nice feel of or sensitivity around his foot and the ground. So it was pretty interesting, because I probably wouldn't have picked that up and noticed that yeah, if you hadn't mentioned something like that.
It took me honestly too long to figure out.
So yeah, I've heard you talk about the unconscious leading the conscious, like a ballroom dance, in terms of when we're moving or when we're running, we shouldn't be consciously thinking about everything that we're doing, and it shouldn't be our conscious mind leading the movement. It should be more following and taking notice and being aware. Can you explain that better than
You've got all
I
my metaphors. You've got
am?
a long list of all of my metaphors. That's great. And I think actually that came about to speak about the learning process even more than about running in specific, because school sets us up to think of learning as something very conscious and intentional. And sport sets us up to think of learning as also something that requires repetition, drilling, cueing, conscious involvement, the need to override, in fact, like none of that touches your self-image, your homunculus, your sensory motor maps. You would already be running better if that map were more accurate, because you would be responding more effectively to this intention to run when supplying the right movements. So when you engage in a learning process, it's like a ballroom dance, that's like your conscious mind and your subconscious mind doing a waltz together, right? And most people would think that it would be and try to learn in a way that the conscious mind is the leader in that partnership, right? You focus on things, you have form focuses, right? You have cues you're trying to implement. You do a movement lesson, and then you intentionally try to apply what you learn from that movement lesson in your running. But in fact, you will probably mess yourself up and certainly frustrate yourself if you try to do that, because your conscious mind does not have the bandwidth, and it is not experiencing the feedback loops. Attempt, sensation, success or failure, revision. that your subconscious mind is experiencing. So the leader in this dance of learning is actually your subconscious mind, is and your conscious mind is just the follower. So that's, yeah, feels totally, it feels absolutely backwards around to a really goal-oriented athlete, right?
Yep.
But a bit of that put together with structured training and, you know, all of that goal orientation, you know, that does have its place in sport, is a magic combination, and will get you much further than trying to be goal oriented about your learning. So you don't know, the very definition of needing to learn something new about movement is that you don't know what you need to learn. If you knew what it was, you would already know it, right?
Yes.
It's the deep unknown. It's the bottom of the ocean, you know? And so that's why the Feldenkrais method is such a powerful tool for improving running, because it can help you discover things you didn't know you didn't know. And that's when you're running. And not only you're running, you know, that's when you get a kind of learning that that makes your running feel like you're a kid again. You know, and then your specific goals, like, well, they just fall like dominoes, you know?
Yes.
And you move easier in your life, and you're more spontaneous, and you're more creative. Like, the brain exists to organize movement. And when you change how you're organizing your movement, when you change what you know, your self-image, you change everything.
Yep. Yep.
I had an elite coach, and I were having a little back and forth about 800 meter form. And he said, you know, try and make this simple. But anyway, he said, have you ever observed that the way people run really matches their personalities perfectly?
Yeah.
And if they changed how they ran, they would probably have to change their personalities too. And I was like, well, yeah, totally. But it's more the other way around. When you change how you run, if you're really learning the things you didn't know, then you don't become somebody else. You become more yourself, but more freely yourself, and you become more versatile, you know, in your life. And you're not so locked into being just one way all the time.
And that's the thing with runners. There's so many sort of perfectionists and type A personalities where like you said, they learn in a race to tough it out or to push to the finish line, and then it kind of like goes against that whole it'd be easy to sort of think that everything should be that way. And a lot of people get stuck in that mindset that we should force and push at everything. It interests me, like, you come from the dance background, Jay. What could runners learn from dancers and the way that dancers go about things?
Well, you know, in a way, I think the key lesson has been learned over the course of the time that I've been doing this work. Because when I started working with runners, let's see, I founded the Balanced Runner in 2006. That was just when the business name was born. I really started working with runners in before I graduated, 2002, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's right. It was like, I was a couple years into working with runners when I finally understood that runners didn't work on their technique. Like, it blew my mind. I just came into it with the assumption, you know, so again, this is like 2002, 2003, you know, well before Born to Run. I just came into it with the assumption that, like, well, of course you work on your technique, you know, as a dancer, you go to class every day. Like that's your, and you start with a plie and you're like, well, where's my plie today?
Yeah.
And where's my tendu? And you know, how, where's my right leg and where's my left leg? And you rediscover it every day, you know? And, you know, the Feldenkrais method changed how I did that also, because I was more open to the butterfly flapping its wings, you know, the chaotic, like,
yep.
What's special about today also, you know, like where's that right leg that I have to have every day, right? But
yeah.
Also what's my way of getting onto my right? So anyway, which was great for being more expressive, creative dancer, but, and I started late. So, you know, 10 years in, I was still learning.
Uh-huh.
You know, I kind of think dancers retire when they go to class and they feel like there's nothing left to learn.
Yeah.
Like, and then it gets really boring. And then, you know, then you're just a machine and you're just waiting for, probably depends on how much of a paycheck you're actually getting. But for modern dance where there's hardly anything, at that point, you really may as well move on. So anyway, you know, like working on your technique, honing your technique, like that's the sine qua non of dance performance. Like,
yeah.
And no matter what style of dance you do, you have a way of doing that. And to me, the idea that as any kind of athlete, you wouldn't do that was very difficult to understand.
Yep.
Now that's changed. That's really changed. It's much more normal for runners to work on their technique. They might not be doing the right things.
Yeah.
They might not even be aiming for the right things, but pretty much every runner is thinking about it to some degree. So I think that's really great.
Yep. And then with your thoughts on running drills and certain sort of exercises like that, do you advocate for doing things like that, like 3 times a week or something like, cause I personally think, they have a place if you're intentional about them and you're noticing, like if you're noticing, you know, how they're making, how they feel or like how a certain aspect of them, or, and if you're individualizing them to the athlete, and making, working on some kind of, movement that you feel like they could benefit from feeling or experiencing. Mm-hmm. And it might be a very exaggerated form of running, like wherever it was like like running over these little wicket hurdles, which force you to constrain you to have shorter ground contact times, and feel what it feels like, to land a bit, or well, to at mid stance, like have your foot under your pelvis a little bit more. If the drill is actually getting the athlete into a position that you feel like, might, make them feel nicer and help with an injury or help with performance, I think they could have their place. And you see a lot of runners doing them, but it's just, I think you see a lot of distance runners kind of just doing them and kind of talking and not really like sort of being too attuned to, how it feels. And it's kind of just become like this tradition, you're just this warm up, that you do.
Yeah. So, there's a whole terrain there of options and effects. And, you know, I think your best way of deciding, you know, what tools are going to be useful is what's your goal?
Yep.
You know, like, what's the athlete's goal? What's the coach's goal in helping this athlete, or a physio's goal or whoever in helping this athlete? And so then that can guide you. I find drills to be a very weak tool for learning.
Yep.
You know, where you're talking about setting up an environment to evoke new movement that requires exploration, I would say that's not a drill. That sounds like a lesson to me. And it is possibly a workout at the same time. That can happen.
Yep.
You know, but if there's a problem to be solved, like the, I don't know, I would have to go to a dictionary now. I kind of wonder what the like actual definition of drill is, but I'm pretty sure repetition is a big part, like an almost rote repetition. And, you know, and so is that useless? Well, anything's completely rote, it's probably close to useless. But if it's not completely rote, if it's just your plies that you do every day when you get to class, you know what I mean? The runner's equivalent of what a dancer does do every day, you know, and it's conditioning and, you know, assuming it's a good fit for running, which I think not all drills are, all of the classic drills.
Mm-hmm.
It's conditioning, it's a warm-up. I mean, I definitely am in favor of a runner having a set of supportive practices that all, well, support healthy running form, and particularly the things that they need reinforcement on. So, you know, a good warm-up, you got to walk at least 10 minutes. And then there are particular directions of movement that you want to make sure you warm up because you've probably been sitting. And that just requires a couple of things, you know? And same for cooling down, post-run stretches, cross-training. I mean, I've created a bunch of resources for those. None of those things are lessons. They just support. If a runner who is not doing Feldenkrais lessons comes and does that stuff, their running is going to feel better anyway. It's just not going to feel as much better as if they were doing lessons because they're not really learning much new from doing that, but they are putting their body in a better place. So I think drills, as long as, again, they're appropriate and as long as you are paying some attention to what you're doing, can be, can definitely have a place in the work a runner does to be a runner, right? I think that distance runners chatting to each other while doing them is much more a function of, you know, distance runners. This was another like sort of amazing discovery I made sort of surprisingly late in my professional practice, tend to tune their bodies out more than they tune in. Yeah. It took working with a couple of master sprinters for me to discover the difference. I mean, a sprinter functions much more like a dancer in terms of, you know, profound self-awareness of movement. And a lot of distance runners cope by just zoning out completely and tuning out their bodies very actively, you know? And so that's, we fixed that.
Now that's fascinating you say that, because I just went to a sprint coaching course about 4 weeks ago, and I was the only distance runner there. And they're such sticklers for technique and working on the quality of movement. And it was an awesome course to go to. And a lot of people were wondering why I was going there, because like I can't sprint and I don't coach any sprinters, but I think we can learn so much from different fields and
that sounds like fun, actually.
Yeah, it was.
When I was consulting to a team, we were at a university track and the university sprint team was working out, and I looked at them and like their color was great and they were laughing and bouncing around, and all their drills, a lot of them looked like stuff I would have done as a dancer. And I thought, now those are the people who are having fun.
Yeah. Yes.
At some point in my life, I've got to try that. But I don't, you know, it's a different sport. My expertise is in distance running. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you see that a lot of runners and practitioners and coaches are getting wrong from a form point of view? And like, what would say like I've listened to you talk about your six main kind of principles that you try to, and it's a good way to talk about it because they're easy to understand or easy to conceptualize. The ones that I like the most, I mean, they're all fantastic, I think, and I've started to look for them too. But I've already, to good effect, used the Mobilize Your Core to run Feldenkrais lesson, and I used it on myself. And look, 5 years ago, I would not have just stood there and listened to something and just twisted and taken notice of different body parts and what they did. And I would have thought, oh, that's doing nothing. I'm just standing here. But I felt so good after it. And my back felt looser, way looser than if I just forced a sustained stretch. I've actually used it on a boy I treat twice a week who has autism and doesn't have the best motor control around his hips, and so he's really stiff and locked up through his spine, and I coach him as well, and I asked him how he felt after the running session just the other week, and he said he's only 16 too, so he didn't know what we were doing in the Feldenkrais lesson, but he was doing it and just trying something out, being open, and he said he just felt awesome. Like he couldn't explain it, but he just felt like really good running. I feel like the Mobilize, the most people's thoughts about what core should be doing in running, like so many people think about like a stiff locked core. I really like your concept of there should be a little bit more movement. So I'd love you to expand maybe on sorry, I've waffled on a little bit, but the core what we should be looking for in a core, and even like hands and hands to heart or the arm piece.
Sure. So yeah, it's great that you brought up the core, you know, relative to, you know, what do people get wrong, because I think that's really the key one. And like we've had a few decades now, I'm blanking on the year this all really started, of the core stability paradigm, which has got to be the worst named paradigm in the world, since that's not stillness is not originally what was meant by that, right? So, you know, and then what's the core anyway? But running and walking require a counter rotation of pelvis and thorax. So why would you try and fight that and expect it would help your running, right? And I think there are a few. So, and yet it's the hardest thing for people to let go of. This idea, the idea that you should be working in your core. And it's not that, like, running should feel relaxed, but it isn't actually relaxed, right? Lying down on the floor is relaxed, and running requires plenty of work. There's no way to do it without plenty of work. But when your work is appropriate, it doesn't feel like work. It feels easy because you're not feeling extra effort or effort that works at counter purposes to what you're trying to do, which Feldenkrais practitioners call parasitic effort. We have a tendency to substitute in order to stay safe, right? Which is like prime directive, gonna stay alive, gonna not get hurt in a way that would end my life. And so we tend to substitute the problem for the solution, or mistake the problem for the solution, because the problem is familiar, right? So I feel stompy and lumbering when I run, and it hurts my back and my knees and probably the soles of my feet too, for the kind of running I'm thinking about here. So there must be something I should do to fix that. And the solution comes either from oneself or more likely from one's physio or Runner's World magazine or whatever, to tighten the core and hold it still. And that seems safe. Keeping the pelvis from moving seems safe. Keeping it from turning, keeping it from tipping, keeping there from being any twisting around the midsection seems safe. And if you do that really actively, you will feel a little different when you run. And there are some reasons why that might even feel good. That would be too complicated to get into. But why does it feel safe? Because it's what you do all day in your chair. Right? And you know that won't kill you, at least not sometime soon, because you're still alive. And so that's what I mean by mistaking the problem for the solution. And I think that's why it's been so difficult for people to let go of that idea. Then also, you know, people, a professional whose job is to work with runners or teach runners, who's been promoting core stability for 20 years, is going to have a hard time saying next week, oh, hey, guys, I was wrong. So also, you know, the professions change slowly. So for all those reasons, very hard to let go of. But there is nothing productive that can be gained by doing anything intentional with your core when you run. The movement will activate the muscles that manage your intra-abdominal pressure, your overall stiffness, stability of parts relative to each other, which doesn't mean immobility, and your elasticity and your breathing. And there's no evidence anyway that we can even think fast enough to micromanage that stuff when we run. And there's no benefit to having an elevated overall tonus in that area when you run. It just makes you move like Frankenstein.
Yeah, or a Lego man.
And the solution is to learn to feel how your legs and arms, how your pelvis and your rib cage need to interact, and then the right muscle actions happen, and you don't have to intend them or control them.
I think and if you just experience it, I think that's the thing. Like, I think you have to just do the lesson, the Feldenkrais lesson, and experience it, and then go for a run, and then feel how it makes you feel. I think these days we there's so much information that we just over intellectualize and just think, and then we don't actually experience different things. I think playing around with that concept, like it makes sense, because I've heard you mention on other podcasts, like it helps with stride length, and then it you're suddenly moving your hips a little bit more, like more forward and back, forward and back, and I can just see how the whole body suddenly just like integrates, like the arms connect to the legs, and you're moving a bit more sort of rhythmically and flowy.
Exactly. I mean, it is the fluidity in running. And for anybody who feels like running is really a pounding, like, this is definitely what you need to learn. It might not be the only thing that you need to learn, but it is definitely what you need. And it's the thing that makes you feel like running is smooth and easy and you could do it forever. And and it's a rolling action, not a pounding action.
With the hands to heart principle, I've heard you talk about, like, if you put your hands in your pockets, how it feels like it changes your weight and your body position, and then if you hold your hands up, how it changes your whole body position. That really helped me, and I've tried it out since on one particular runner that just springs to mind, because he just looks so tense through his shoulders, and just getting him to try it. I didn't say anything. I said, just try this and see what you think. And he kind of got the principle straight away, and he just was like, that just feels more natural. Like, I just feel better. Like, I feel like I'm moving forward better, easier. He's gravitated to it straight away. Like, it was like an aha moment. Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's great. Yeah. And that's exactly what I mean by a feedback loop in learning. Like, you told him something to try. But not in the sense of, okay, so try doing this every time you run. And then he's just trying to follow instructions, but instead he tries and feels, oh, wait a minute, you know, feedback.
Yeah.
I can tell.
Yeah.
That's easier. Then he's learned.
Yeah.
Then he's learned something. That's great. Yeah. And so often, like, you know, that arm tent, and this is the thing about my 6 like keys to becoming a balanced runner are that they are all parts of a single whole body action, because there isn't like arm form, like what you should do with your arms in running. It's not a bunch of like puzzle pieces or a laundry list. It's like, it's a single action, and we could talk about any part of that action, right? But these are, I find, the 6 easiest, and they kind of cover the bases, and they all reinforce each other. So you start with what you've got, with what's working, and then you'll find that that begins to produce other ones of those keys. So in the case of this client, you know, probably he didn't have his core action really working well. That tends to be what's going on when a person's arms are super tense and they can't feel what to do with them. It's like, well, because you're kind of trying to stiffen your core and not move it, so there's no rotational action of the thorax to connect the arms to.
Yes.
Right? So, and sometimes all you have to do is bring the arms in. I mean, like, that worked for him. And that might not work for the next person with visibly the exact same problem, right? Because the image in the mind is different. And the experiment might not produce the same discovery. So then that becomes the art of teaching, right? What does this, I can see, and that's like, you know, from a professional standpoint, that's what makes this so fun.
Yeah,
and that's what makes it like really touch the person, is because two runners making the identical mistake might be doing it for entirely different reasons, you know? And so what's going on in this in their nervous system? What do they know that's working? And what is it that they need to know that would make all the difference? And then how can you set up a situation where they discover it for themselves?
And you worked that out through doing a really detailed like history, like interview and chatting to the patient, and then just trial and error. Like, you just try things. Like,
yeah. 20 years of trial.
Yeah.
Yeah. And luckily, like, my practice is at the moment entirely online. So I went online in 2016. Due to a sequence of international moves. It was like the only thing that made sense. But I only feel like I actually got good at working online like last year.
Yeah.
But that was on the back of having worked entirely in person for over a decade, mm-hmm. right? Mostly one-to-one, but also workshops. And I never could have done the online without that in-person thing. So yeah, I do, like, again, like online, I require more clues from like history and life experience than I necessarily do in person, though it's still very valuable in person. Because if there's a really complicated history of injury, or if a person, say, is a horseback rider, you know, or has some other activity that they've done a lot of, even if it was in their childhood and they haven't done it as an adult, that still is shaping their movement habits. And I definitely find that the more I can address how a sequence of injury was initiated, and or, you know, what the person learned about themselves from the activities that they did through their lives, Like those are the more powerfully I can help them improve their running. So those turn out to be the very best levers.
That's fantastic. And it shows how complex it is and how individual everyone is in terms of because it is that collection of life experiences and beliefs and injuries and just structurally how we're all so different. So there's a lot that goes into it, but I'd like to just finish with two more things, Jay. Like, you've been so generous with your time. I'd like to hear if you had like any patients lately that you've treated online where you were absolutely stumped and you didn't know what to do, or someone where it was just such a fantastic success story that you still find yourself thinking about it even now or during the day, where you were just a bit in shock of like of what happened.
Right. Okay. Well, it's easier to remember the problems than the great successes, right?
Because I
thought so much more about the problems. Like a success, like I'm thrilled for a day, but then life moves on. But this sort of gets to, like, there's one thing I wanted to say just in response to the conversation we just had, and how you conclude, because there's this thing where, like, so running is a fundamental human gait, and we all have basically the same equipment, although, you know, with lots of variation. But the funny thing about it is, although, you know, everybody as a person is different, and their history is different, and how they learn is also different, but if you take that all into account and you give a person a way of learning that they own, it's amazing how an enormously diverse pool of runners will start to run more and more similarly when they have the lessons that they need. So you have to hold two ideas at once, which is that everybody's different and running is all the same.
Yeah.
In a certain sense, right? And then handle those ideas relative to each other in the right way. I know some people believe that there are lots of good ways to run. I mean, you know, it is a marker of the evolutionary importance of running to us that we can pull it off a million different ways depending on what we're trying to do. You know, and we can carry something and run, and we can push something and we can kick something and run, you know, we can be injured and run, as everybody knows. So we can pull it off lots of ways, but the principles of optimal form, the physics of it, are always the same. So, and then there's some technical versatility, but, you know, everybody should be running more the same than they are.
That's what
I have to say about that. But that's not something you impose. That's something each person comes to themselves by discovering their own self and how running works in their body.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. I had a couple of other guests on who sort of said the similar principle, like there's like a bandwidth in terms of variation, but like, you know, there's some commonalities and what Franz Bosch sort of calls it attractors or like there's just some, you can actually just see it, you know, like when you're watching sort of like a high level race at the Olympics, say, you know, compared to say a local park run, you know, you can see that like at the Olympic level, like they're more reactive. They look more like if you just look outside and you watch an animal move, they just look beautiful and they move, you know, gracefully. You would say that when you're watching the Olympic sort of field, like they've practiced it so much, they've explored their movement so much that there's still like people where you're like, oh, I think they could potentially focus on things a little bit more here and there. But then at the same time, compared to a park run field, you can see a wider variation in terms of form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, you certainly can.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the truth. Just briefly to your question of I have for the past 5 years or so, I've had a sequence of a small handful of runners come through my practice with real struggles with chronic calf tension cramps, especially, and it took me a while to realize even, it's deep calf, it's not gastroc, it's not soleus, it's deep calf. And it's just been so hard to help them get a handle on it. And general calf tightness, calves are never tight because of anything to do with the calves. They're usually tight because of a stiff torso. And so they're having to overwork to push the runner forward because the rest of the body isn't cooperating. But that principle just wasn't enough to help a small handful of clients. And then we moved into a new house and I took a permaculture design course and I killed all the grass and I spent all of last year turning our whole property into a garden, which meant endless hours of digging and crouching. And suddenly I understood. Some problems you just have to have yourself before you understand. And I realized, all of those people, two of them were gardeners professionally, and the other three were manual work, repair people or handymen of various kinds, who worked a lot in a crouching or kneeling position. And it's this deep, deep hip flexion for endless hours of a work day leads to all kinds of deep calf problems. And then suddenly I was able to create effective solutions. So, this is where doing something for decades, you finally start, even for the edge cases, even for kind of obscure problems, I've been able to have enough clients that I can start to see patterns.
Yeah.
Then again, if I'm fortunate enough, quote unquote, to develop the problem myself,
yeah.
Then this is why, this is what's great about having been a dancer and loving doing, a variety of things myself, is that I'm always learning, and I'm always learning within running and also by stepping out of running.
Yes.
So, I went ice skating yesterday, learned a lot.
No, I think that speaks volumes. That's what makes you a good practitioner, is you're always learning and you love your craft. You can see it and you're passionate about it. I find I've had a lot of Achilles trouble in my running, and that's the injury that I'm probably most confident in being empathetic with patients and feel most confident in terms of treating. So it's mm-hmm. yeah, you yeah. often the personal experience helps a lot. I just wanted to quickly get your thoughts on strength training as well. In terms of what do you sort of recommend for strength training? How do you sort of approach it? I'm just interested to hear your thoughts there.
So so I think strength training is valuable, and I think it's valuable in two ways. First, it can help performance, and although your average everyday runner doesn't necessarily, I'm not of the school that you have to train strength train if you want to run healthy. The people who say that are the people who don't understand running form. Running builds the strength needed to run. The same way strength training builds the strength needed to strength train, you get out what you put in.
Yep.
So I don't believe you need to do some other kind of strengthening activity in order to be strong enough to run. But if you have competition goals, or even you just want to, you know, run trail ultras to finish, and, you know, like that's going to be helpful. The other thing is, as a human being, you do need to be able to do things in addition to running. So if you just want to be a fit and healthy human being, running is not going to be sufficient, especially as you get older.
Yes.
And I've really embraced that myself. I love my time in the gym, actually. But if running is a priority in your life, then you need to make sure that at least some of the strength training activities you do are a fit for the movement demands of running, because you can really mess yourself up. I think a lot of folks who do CrossFit get into this problem, actually. So in running, the two sides of your body are always doing opposite things. There's never a moment when they're not. And so if you are staying really square and doing everything bilaterally in your strength training, if it's all squats and Olympic lifting and, you know, working with barbells, and, you know, then you're going to start feeling strangely stiff, and you're going to lose your fluidity when you run. Mm-hmm. You can do some of that stuff. That's fine. But at least at the end of each workout, you should do unilateral stuff. So that is, you know, one side at a time, or the two sides doing opposite things that match up better with the movement demands of running. So you're setting up those movement patterns last thing before you walk out of the gym. Mm-hmm. And that's usually enough to help you, you know, build the strength that you want to build and retain your fluidity and have that strength actually become usable in your running.
Yeah.
So I have a little three-move upper body strength sequence that I made a YouTube video of that I've been doing for years, that where you're moving your legs and you're shifting your weight even as you're working with dumbbells in your upper body. And it translates really well to healthy running form. And so just even that sequence is a great last thing to do after strength training in the gym. But like general principles, you want to be making sure you have enough unilateral stuff, and you want to have enough things that move your core. So standing rotational, like turning your pelvis, tipping your pelvis, twisting your body, or you can turn everything the same direction. But if the upper body is turning past the lower body, as, you know, if you're doing some sort of standing cable rotation thing or a chop or whatever, that becomes a spiraling activity. So that's also good. So that's kind of my overview on that. Does that answer your question?
No, that's fantastic. That's really useful. I'm so grateful for everything we've talked about, and I would really want if people found Jay interesting, like, go to the Balanced Runner. Like, you've got a website, and
balancedrunner.com.
Do you mind filling everyone in about that, because there's some amazing blogs that I've just been reading avidly the last week or two, and YouTube clips, and you've got an online camp as well, which I'll sign up to in the next week.
So my website is balancedrunner.com, and I have a YouTube channel by the same name. Unfortunately, if you're on YouTube and the channel is Balanced Runner, but it's an Australian guy, that's somebody else. So on YouTube, unlike in the internet, you can have two channels with the same name. So that gets confusing. But I've got a lot of YouTube videos. I did a daily live stream in the first year of COVID, so there's a ton of material there. So really demoing the stuff that I talk about. And for a lot of people, you know, like, I think there are two prongs on my educational, like, efforts have two prongs. And one of them is creating these movement experiences that help you learn the thing you don't know, that would make all the difference. But the other is correcting the idea that's out there about what running even is, right? Because the world is full of runners trying really hard to learn how to do the wrong thing because they read some article about it, you know, to hold their core tight, or to make their arms go front to back, or whatever it is, or to run upright. And so I do a lot of talking about how running really works. And for a lot of runners, just getting that information makes a huge difference, just changing the idea of what even is this activity that I'm trying to do. So that's really what the YouTube channel is for. So I definitely take a look at that. And I've got playlists, like if you want it, and there'll be more. I also do elite running form analysis. And so there are some videos on the YouTube channel from the past year. Next year, there'll be more of that and more videos specifically on how to resolve running injuries that have been very stubborn. I have a free 1 week challenge called the Mind Your Running Challenge that I have a dream that every runner will do, that will be like your basic education in running form. So it sits somewhere between those two prongs. It gives you movement experiences, 10 minutes a day, so that you can feel and not just have your head full of abstract ideas, but also there's explanation of how running works. And so for a lot of people, that's a great place to start. The online camp is full-length Feldenkrais lessons. That's where you get a real transformation. If you go to my website, you can put Mind Your Running in the search bar, or you can look for the little widget that says Start Here, and that will get you to the Mind Your Running Challenge.
Jay, that absolutely fantastic. It's been an absolute privilege to chat to you and to hear you describe everything, and I think there's so much to it, and I really urge runners to investigate like the Feldenkrais approach and a lot of your material, because I certainly am, and it's definitely the direction that I'm enjoying going and adding to my sort of practice and as well, like, and I feel like it's making me better, and I'm sure others will benefit from it too. So you're doing a great job, and all your hard work over a long time I think is helping a lot of people. So thanks for chatting today.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the conversation. You're doing great work, and it's always exciting to meet someone who's just really excited about learning and helping runners that way. Working together, we're going to fill this world with a lot of healthier, happier runners than we've had in the past. So,
awesome. Thank you.
Best of luck to you. Take care.